Blog Talk Radio.
We have here of the Story Blender with very special guest, comedian, author, and playwright Bob Stromberg. Of course, the Story Blender is hosted by author Stephen James and Jose Castillo, coming live to you here every other Friday only on the Fitch Radio Network. So before we get right into the show, we are going to have to listen to a little bit of messages from our sponsors, and then we'll hop right into the Story Blender again with very special guest, comedian, author, and playwright Bob Stromberg. So enjoy the show.
Okay, everybody, here we go. We got some great new stuff for you guys to check out. Author David Lyons is back with his latest book in his Jock Boucher series, Waters of Oblivion. This is the third book in the series, and it could possibly be the best. Here at Suspense Magazine, we call it a must-read, a great espionage thriller, so you need to check out DavidLyonsAuthor.com for a lot more information on this book and the rest of the series. Midnight Ink is celebrating 10 years of great mystery suspense books, and we are always excited to receive a new Midnight Ink book, just because we always know it's of the very highest quality with fabulous authors. Make sure that you visit midnightinkbooks.com and discover some of those fabulous new authors to place on your shelf. Would you become a serial killer to save your child? Because that's one of the questions author Mike Pace asks in his latest book, One to Go. Steve Barry says terrific, ripping good, explosive excitement, says Douglas Preston, and relentlessly suspenseful, says John Land. So you need to visit MikePaceBooks.com for more information on that. Also, new from author Jamie Mason is Monday's Lie. Jamie May placed her name solidly in the suspense genre with her last book, Three Graves Full, and Monday's Lie should appeal to fans of The Americans and Homeland. So do yourself a favor, check out Monday's Lie, and visit Jamie on her website at jamie-mason.com. Don't forget the hyphen. Now, when Brad Thor calls your book awesome and one of the hottest authors in the thriller genre, you definitely need to start taking notice. And from Kensington Press is author Mark Cameron with his latest book, Day Zero. Also, Candace Fox brings horror abound in her latest book, Hades. So visit kensingtonbooks.com for a lot more on all of their titles. To Catch a Satanic Killer, Detective Jennifer Mueller will go into the Devil's Reach. And that's the title of author Lewis Weinberg's latest book. It's graphic, gritty, wildly entertaining are just some of the words that are being used to describe this latest thriller. So make sure you go to Lewis Weinberger, WeinBerger.com for a lot more information on everything he's got going on. And just remember, we want to tell everyone to make sure that you check out all of our sponsors by visiting to suspensemagazine.com. You can get the magazine, see what all we have going inside. And thanks for all the support that you all guys do, because without you, we wouldn't have this radio show and these magazines, and we wouldn't be able to bring this fine stuff to you. So, again, we want to thank all of you guys out there for listening, and enjoy the show. And
welcome to the Story Blender. I'm Stephen James.
And I'm Jose Castillo.
And this is where great storytellers share the secrets of great storytelling. And I'm excited today because our guest, Bob Stromberg, is not only a storyteller, he's a comedian, he's a playwright. I don't even know where to start in trying to tell you about his background. He's also a shadow storyteller. He has appeared all over the world. He and a couple of his buddies wrote a little comedy show back in the day called Triple Espresso. Millions of people, 44 cities have seen it. 6 countries have attended this show. And it ran in Minneapolis for 12 years and San Diego for 11 years. I mean, what theatrical program shows for 11 straight years. But I've seen it. It's hilarious. Triple espresso is just one of the many things Bob has put out there. And thanks for joining us.
Oh, you bet. My pleasure. Thank you, guys.
And may I just say, it's so refreshing to have a comedian on. And, you know, we've been talking about thrillers and murders and grisly things. And, you know, and I'm excited just to take a little bit of a laugh break. We're not going to ask you to do any jokes or anything. But
I appreciate that, too.
Because there's nothing worse than a comedian saying, hey, you're a comedian. Tell me a joke.
Be funny. That's right.
I know it's like a doctor. Oh, you're a doctor. Could you just perform surgery on me here in the living room for me?
I actually had a doctor say to me on the phone, what are you doing? I said, I'm a comic. And he said, oh, well, tell me a joke. And he said it so that most of the first class section could – I was in first class because I fly so much – and could hear it. And they all looked at me, and, boy, I came this close to saying, no, you're a doctor. Check out this rash, you know, expose myself to him.
Our paths crossed years ago, probably I'd say maybe 16 years ago. I remember I was trying to get started as a writer and a storyteller, and I read one of your books called When Geese Fly Farther Than Eagles. I don't even know if it's still in print. And I remember saying, this guy is out there telling stories like I want to do. And I don't even know if you remember, but I called you up out of nowhere. I went on the phone, I went online or whatever, found your name, found a number in Minneapolis, and I called you. And I said, hey, look, I'm this guy, Stephen James, and, you know, I want to be a storyteller, and it sounds like you're doing what I want to do. And you just, for like half an hour, you just chatted with me and gave me some advice and pointed me directions to go. And it was fantastic. I mean, most people, you know, a lot of people in your shoes might have said, who are you? You know, what are you calling me for? But it was just
I did. I think I said, who are you? And you told me, and I thought, oh, great. Well, I'm happy to talk to this guy because he sounds serious about what he's doing. And
Read my book. He's one of the four people out there, you know.
That particular one, yeah. I do remember meeting you very well. In fact, unless I have it wrong, it was in New Orleans at a big convention down there.
And then we were at an event down there,
and,
I think, yeah.
Yeah, and or maybe you called me up before that, actually, and talked to me, and then I met you down there. But anyway, you bet, it was a long time ago.
Now, I hate to almost use this word, but some people have described you as a mime.
Yeah.
It's a four-letter word these days, but you use a lot of physical comedy in your storytelling and your comedy.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I have a new show. Actually, it's 5 years old, but it's only now in its fourth production. Theater's an expensive business. I'll tell you, if things don't take off for you right away like they did with Triple Espresso, we had a hit right out of the gate with that show. So we've been able – in fact, we're on our 20th anniversary of it right now in 2015, which is amazing to me. But unless a show takes off like that, it just costs so much money to produce theater. But I have a one-man show called That Wonder Boy, which will be opening in the end of March here in Minneapolis, where I live. I'm actually in the St. Paul side, but in the Twin Cities. And it's a show about art. And the reason I mention this is because you mentioned about mime. And when we talk about storytelling, we're really talking about art. And what is it about storytelling? What is it that touches us? What is it that grabs our heart? What is it that makes us laugh, that moves us emotionally, whatever those emotions are, whether it's we're laughing or we're crying or anything in between, or it makes us angry or it makes us upset? What is it about storytelling that does that? I first became enamored by art, believe it or not, when I was 8 years old. True story. I sat in my third grade music class, and Miss Nagel, my music teacher, sat at her upright, spilling over the bench, her back end was spilling over the bench of our classroom's upright piano, and she was banging out the chords to number 14. At the top of the page in our music book was this thin picture depicting an Amish-looking fellow walking through a summer meadow, and at the base of the page was, or the picture was a little splash of blue river in the background of approaching storm clouds. And over the din of my classmates' voices, which in retrospect probably didn't sound all that pretty, but I heard the song Shenandoah. and there was something in the lyrics, or excuse me, probably not the lyrics, there was something in the melody of that song, or in the coloring of the chords, or something that just moved me so deeply, and I burst into tears. And keep in mind, this is not a boy who's having trouble at home or any other concerns in his life. I mean, I was just one happy little guy. Everything, I had an idyllic childhood. And I heard that song, and I burst into tears. And I remember all my classmates looked at me like, what's the matter with you? And I was embarrassed. And Miss Nagel walked back and asked me point blank, you know, what's wrong? Are you okay? And, of course, I'm 8 years old. I don't know how to explain. How's an eight-year-old be overwhelmed by the beauty of art, you know? And then there were other art assaults that happened to me in my boyhood. I remember as a sophomore in high school, waiting on a dangerously cold winter evening for my mom to pick me up after basketball practice, which was unusual in itself because I always walked the mile and a half home. But on this evening she'd agreed to come because it was so cold and she didn't want me to get frostbite or lose a toe again. So I was standing in the foyer, in this dark foyer, and I could hear the squeaks of the shoes in the back of the varsity was practicing. And I turned to the left, and our Chamber of Commerce in our town had bought these life-size but cheap frame prints of great art masterpieces. And there was Van Gogh's Starry Night. And this shaft of light was coming from the parking lot through the window of the foyer right on that painting. And I looked at it, and I just felt this swelling in my chest. Now, I know this sounds crazy, but this is what happened. I felt the swelling in my chest. It was the same feeling. Like, why do I, gee. Here I'm trying to be this tough high school kid, you know, and I'm feeling, I look at a painting and I feel like I'm going to cry. Like, what is the matter with me? But there was something, I didn't know what it was, but in retrospect I realized, and there are many examples of this that I've, in my show I've been able to kind of pinpoint, but I realized that in the presence of real beauty, something inside of me, of my spirit, just soared. And it was this connection I later came to understand was this connection with art. There's something whether it's a song, whether it's hearing a story, often when I hear truth, there's something about truth that moves me. And as I've gotten older now, and I'm in my 60s now, and I've found that I actually am moved more easily than I even used to be. But mime was one of those things. I first saw mime when I was 19. It was the last night of my first trip abroad, and it was in Paris, and I saw that Marcel Marceau was performing at the Paris Opera House.
Wow.
And I realized this is the same Marceau who I used to, as a little boy, watch on Ed Sullivan.
Yeah.
And so I took my last $20, which was a lot of money back in those days, and I went to the show. And the next night I took my roommate's last $20, and my roommate with me, we went back again. And it was just a mastery of an essence of gesture. It was to movement what poetry is to literature, where one little lifted eyebrow or one tiny little change of expression could bring the house down. And I was moved in the same way. I mean, sometimes just laughing hysterically, but just deeply moved by that performance. And I said, I want to learn how to do that. I was in college at the time. So when I graduated from college, my mom and dad said, what are you intending to do with your life, young man? And I said, I'm going to mime school. And believe it or not, and this goes to show how well my mom and dad knew me and know me still, both of them without hesitation said, oh, Bob, that's perfect. And I went to this theater school up in the state of Maine in a four-story horse barn, and I studied for two summers and part of a winter up there. It literally was 7 days a week. And I learned about this art form, and I learned about gesture, and I learned about facial expression, and a lot of stuff that I was doing naturally anyway. And fortunately, my mime teacher, his name was Tony Montanaro, just a genius teacher. He was not interested in producing a bunch of white-faced minds to go out in the parks. He was interested in teaching gesture and teaching movement, teaching certainly mind illusions that could be used in story. But he was more. It was more important to him that he find what is the essence of you as an artist. What do you want to? What do you want to do? What do you want to be? How do you want to communicate? And he had a real knack for going to each one of us and saying, "Oh, this is your area. These are parts of your development. You need to come along a little bit in these areas, but this is the essence of who you are." And in my case, it involved a fair amount of verbiage, as you can tell from our conversation already. So, you've asked me one. You said the word mime, and I've been talking for the last 10 minutes. So, but it is. I mean, storytelling is whether you also mentioned the shadow work that I do. That was a movement thing, sort of a novelty act that I began playing around with. But I realized what a wonderful old vaudeville thing this is. It was wonderful back then, and it's still wonderful today. And I've actually been working on creating shadows, hand shadows, for 20 years. And it's only one little small part of the one little thing that I can do. But I've found in creating a career in performing, you pretty much use everything you have. So, I mean, if you're a juggler, or if you play the musical saw, or if you or the nose harp, you're going to use it somewhere in there. You're going to need it. And so the hand shadows are coming really handy for me, because they have opened up lots and lots of doors for me around the world, where people have said, you know, can you come to London, or can you come to Turkey or whatever, and can you do your hand shadows? Because it's unique. It's kind of like your dad, Jose, Joe Castillo, who does the sand art. It's such a unique kind of storytelling that people want to see it because they haven't seen it before. And the hand shadows have been that for me. So
now, sometimes we talk to storytellers from different paths, writers, actors, speakers, and you've pretty much kind of done it all. And when I think about some of the work that I've seen, boy, there's comedy in some of the stuff that you've done, the stories you tell, but also poignancy, where it isn't just it's clean comedy, but it isn't just comedy to laugh. It's comedy to laugh and then make you think at the end. When you're creating new material, how do you go about that? Is it a process of brainstorming? Is it a process of already thinking about the audience beforehand? How do you shape that material that you develop?
Well, of course, I'm always thinking about the audience, because you need to know who your audience is. I began my career back in the 70s performing in schools. So I was with kids kindergarten through third grade, K to 6, K to 8, 7 and 8, high school, the whole, all those school-age kids. And so, and each one of them is different. K to 3 is different than 4 to 6. So I was creating material as I got to know these audiences and understand the kind of things they responded to and what they could understand or what they couldn't. I began creating material for them. High school obviously is very different than kindergarten through third grade. So it's what works
yeah.
with these kids. How can I get through to this group in this inner city school in Cleveland when I'm standing out in the middle of a gym floor tied to a 6-foot cord, you know, plugged into a stand up podium? You know, how can I get through to these kids? So that's always really important, to know who your audience is. But then, how do I get material? I sure wish there was an easy way to do that, I'll tell you, because I've said to lots of guys who I've talked with who ask the same question because they're interested for themselves, I said there really is no easy way, and you've got to have material. You've got to have stuff. If you stand up in front of 1,000 people, you better have something that's going to work, that's going to communicate. What I found, the process that works for me is, I've told people, here's how you get it. Now, you notice how I inflected the word get. I said, here's how you get it. And get, of course, is spelled G-I-T. The G stands for grab. How do you get material? Here's how you do it. You grab anything that grabs you emotionally. And once again, when I say emotionally, I don't mean something that, that moves you to tears, although it might be that. It might make you angry. It might make you or perplex you in some way. It might make you sad. It might make you just laugh hysterically, and anything in the realm of emotion. So if you hear a story, or if you see something happen in your life, or as in my case, I'm always mining the past, my own past, to find things that move me emotionally. Recently, I inherited from my mom and dad, I inherited their our family slides, which is 20 large carousels, each carousel containing 100 photographic slides. and they, it's actually one of my funnier comic bits because I put together a show of the worst of those 2,000 slides. They're just horrendously bad. They are horrendously bad. We have so many double exposures, which were very funny. We have, and of course, all slideshows back then had blanks where, for one reason or another, slides have been taken out, and you might get 6 blanks in a row that are blinding the people watching the slideshow. But as I looked at these slides of myself at different ages, I would look at a picture of myself standing at Niagara Falls, 12 years old, and going, okay, now why was I there? Who was I there with? And stories, I can hear these stories in my head. As I remember things, a family vacation, one of the few that we took when I was 14, we flew from Buffalo, New York, to California, and there's a picture of my two sisters and I sitting on a park bench in the Detroit airport. Well, as I'm looking at that picture, I remember that was the day that, as a kid, I'm 14 years old now, I actually ran into a huge pop band at the time, Gary Lewis and the Playboys, who had like 9 number one hits. And I was a real fan of pop music back then, and there's this band. So I had a story about running into and experiencing fame for the first time in my life. I didn't
– sure.
And what that felt like, and it moved me. So anyway, looking through these 2,000 slides are just – dozens and dozens of stories, of which I've found a few that work really well on stage. So, but it all came down to grabbing something that moved me emotionally. Then once I grab it, and by grab it I mean write it down, because if you don't write it down or put it in a file in the computer, which is I do in my case, put it in a file where I know where it is so I can go back, because I stands for interrogate. So I grab what grabs me emotionally, and then I interrogate it. What does this mean? Why does this story, this memory, move me still as I think about it? Not only that, but what am I feeling? What is there something universal about what I'm feeling that other people would relate to too, that they would feel as well if I'm able to develop the story? What, in other words, what is the meaning? What's the purpose of this story? Because I don't want to just stand up and just talk. I want to do something that is going to move people the way I was moved by this. Then once I've identified, here's the truth in this story. Here's what's universal in this story. It's unique to me, but there's something universal about it. Once I've identified that, then the T in GIT stands for transform. Then I need to transform this thought, this story, into something that actually sings, that is beautiful, that does make people laugh, that does make people feel the anger that I felt, or any of those emotions. And, of course, that's done through language. First of all, the actual telling of the story, how do I tell it? If I'm telling it in a traditional storytelling kind of way with language, then I personally am going to sit down at the computer and I'm going to type away for a number of days to get something that starts to work, so that I don't, in my case, I would have, if I don't do that, I'll have way too much verbiage. I will be talking and I'll just be yapping on and on and on, and people will lose the whole point and the story won't have any purpose or any power at all. But if I can get all that yapping down on the page and then edit away all that doesn't belong there, I start to get down to the essence of something. And then it gets down to, okay, can I say that better? Can I be more descriptive in this phrase when I'm describing my music teacher? Can I describe her in less words but with more power? And then it's that editing, and that's the writing process. Then once I've done that, Then it comes down to memorizing that story. It's very seldom that I would read it from the page, although I have done that occasionally because it seems to work with a particular type of story, to actually sit at a podium and read it. That can have some power to it. But more often, I would memorize what I've written, and then now what's happening with my body, what's happening with my voice. I know what my physical tools are. I know that I'm able to move well. Some stories really give me an opportunity to use that mind training from way back then, and it can work well. Other times, of course, I'm working on facial expressions. I don't have the voice that you're hearing is pretty much the voice that I use in a lot of storytelling, and it's bigger, it's louder when I'm on stage, of course. But one of the tools I don't have is the ability to talk with different inflections from all over the country, which would be wonderful, or around the world. So anyway, I know what my tools are. So once I've done that, okay, now start to put it together. And then it comes down to, all right, I'm going out there today. I'm going to put it on the stage. I have a performance. So let me see. Who is this audience? Okay, this is a corporate deal. These are investors, and it's kind of like a holiday party. And I'm down, my contract says that I'm supposed to do 35 minutes. So this looks to me from my rehearsal that it's about a six-minute piece. I'm going to try to squeeze that in between two other things that I know will work. because I'm not completely confident that this will. So I'll squeeze it in there and see how it goes. So.
That's awesome. You know, one of the interesting things of coming from the physical background is a lot of people who write stories are doing it with words on paper. They're sitting down in front of a computer, or, you know, some people may still be using a pen and paper, et cetera. But the power of the body and the body in motion and how you carry yourself when you're sharing a story in a physical presence, how do those things play into, you know, any storytelling? What are some things that people can do from that carry over from that physical side into storytelling in all manners?
But you don't mean on stage now. You mean just in general?
Yeah, just in general. Because I think a lot of people, and this is something I've found in talking with people that are learning about writing or learning about communication or even in the corporate world and marketing and technology, is that they've learned what a good story is, but they don't know necessarily how to present that, how to stand up, how to use their body, use the physical parts of their body to help share that story. I think that's important in all storytelling, is to think about that.
Well, it really is. If you're just sitting around the table, then, you know, people are going to do kind of what comes natural to them sitting around the table. If people actually have an interest in becoming a storyteller, or if they're people who have a need to use stories where they are, if they're communicators, if they're pastors, preachers, teachers, if they're in the corporate world, if they're salespeople and they have a need to communicate that way through story, I always tell people, do whatever you can to get in front of people to do this. Because people have to find, they have to find their own voice. I think there's a tendency sometimes, and I even have this tendency sometimes, if I watch another comic, and I don't do this extensively, by the way, purposefully, but sometimes somebody will say, oh, you've got to check out Brian Regan. You're going to love this CD. And I'll watch him. And I'll look at this, DVD, I'll look at this material and I'll go, oh, I could do that, you know. Man, I wish I'd written that, because I can do that piece. But I don't want to, and I ought not try to sound like he sounds, or to even to develop a piece the way that Brian Regan would do it. I have to find the way that I would do it, to do it best. Because I just think it's so important to find an authentic voice as a storyteller that doesn't sound like somebody else. It should sound like you telling a story. So I've sat down for coffee with people who have said, "Oh, I'd love to be able to move the way you do when you tell that story. Can you help me to do that?" And I said, "Well, I can help you a little bit with that." But it's going to have to be what you feel comfortable with in your own body. Because if you try to make faces like I make faces, you're probably going to look really stupid. And it's actually going to be, because I look really stupid, but it works on me. It works on my face when I... people say to me, oh, you must practice those expressions, don't you? And I tell them, if I looked in the mirror and did these facial expressions, I would never use them on stage because I look so stupid to me. But they work because there's something authentic about it. I've been doing it. This might be a key right here, you guys. I've been doing this. What I do now at age 62, I've been doing a lot of this stuff facially and even with my body. My whole life, I mean, from the time I was a child, I was able to make people laugh or I was able to make people pay attention by what I did with my face and with my expressions, with my gestures. It's a natural thing for me. And so I've often told people, when you look back on your childhood, if you've always wanted to be an entertainer or a communicator, when you look back on your childhood, what are the things that you used to do that used to delight people back then? What used to delight your family or your brothers and sisters? Or if you were the class clown, what is it that you used to do that really worked? Because you shouldn't let that stuff go. There's probably some real gems in there that you should hold on to and use even now in your communication. I'm not sure. I don't know if that makes sense to you, but
totally. Yeah, it does. And when you were telling that, it made me think of when I was actually in college. There was this girl that I liked, and so I asked her out for ice cream or whatever, and we went out. And as a speaker and performer, I'm much more comfortable up in front of an audience than I am just a couple people around a kitchen table. And
sure.
So I start telling her about my life or whatever, getting to know her and stuff. And about 20 minutes into it, she goes, "Steve, I got to tell you something." I'm like, "Yeah, what's that?" And she says, "I feel more like your audience than your friend." And it was a huge wake-up call to me because I realized I was performing my life story for this girl.
Sure.
I mean, I wasn't telling her a story like you would, you know, get like having a conversation with somebody. I was slipped into performance mode, and, you know, we never really got married and lived happily ever after, but it really taught me, you know, a lot about getting to know your audience and telling it an authentic way to that audience.
Yeah, if it's authentic, if you're authentic on stage, I think it will feel to somebody like you are talking just to them sitting across the table from them.
Yeah.
Even if your movements are big and you're using lots of expressions that you wouldn't be that way at the table because you'd attract the attention of everybody in the restaurant. But if you are authentic on stage in front of 1,000 people, I think people will go, "Boy, I felt like he or she. I thought she was talking just to me." And that's the way it should feel, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's good. When you think of you've been, you know, entertaining audiences for a long time, for decades.
Yeah.
Do you see things changing today in the way that we as communicators can connect with, you know, the audiences that we're speaking to? Or do you find there's more universal aspects to it? I mean, you mentioned that you've been doing some of this stuff, some of your material for years and years, and people still love it.
Yeah. Well, I'm often told that that the world is changing and that what used to work doesn't work anymore. I seem to hear that a lot from people, but not people who are responding to my performances.
Hey, good.
Fortunately, they're not coming up saying, "You know, that doesn't work with the kids these days. That doesn't work with families anymore." I'm really finding. When I look back on my material, for example, I mean, honestly, I look back on stuff that I was doing 35 years ago. And, maybe I shouldn't feel this way because I still have old folks coming and saying, "Oh, I saw you there and you did this piece and I thought I just loved it so much and could I get a copy even all these years later?" I look back on it and I go, "Oh, my goodness, I'm embarrassed to think that I was even doing that," because I feel like I've grown as an artist, and I look back on some of the old material, and it it just doesn't it doesn't make it for me anymore. I just don't think it's what it should be. And I suppose that's good because I think I am. I think I am. Honestly, you guys,
I'm getting
honestly,
better.
I honestly feel like I've finally figured it out. I mean, in just the last few years, I've gone, I think I finally am good at this. But it's taken this long. It's taken this long, and I'm so thankful when I look back and people say, oh, I love what you did 30 years. Could you do that again tonight? And I wouldn't consider doing that piece because I just don't think it's a good story, or I don't think I was authentic or I was honest, and lots of times I was winging it, but I was able to pull it off. And that was all in the process of learning who I am and what my voice is. So to answer your question, I am still being me. I am still doing me when I'm performing, when I'm telling stories, when I'm doing comedy, when I'm doing shadows, when I am still being Bob Stromberg, and it still works. In fact, I think it works better than it ever did before. I'm not doing very much material from 30 years ago, but I'm doing a few pieces from 20 years, and they still work beautifully. And even in this digital age, I was watching The Voice last night, and an artist came on, and they're in the finals, and all these big numbers are being sung, and a guy came out with his guitar, and he had his guitar and a cello, and the simplicity of that was so beautiful and really moving to me. And that answers the question a little bit that you just asked me, because it was authentic. And I think people, even in this digital age, and even when they say that, you know, people these days they don't have an attention span that can exceed, you know, 4 minutes at a time or 3 minutes at a time, because that's what they're used to when they're flipping through, for not even 3 minutes. You know, if you put a YouTube up that's 3 minutes, nobody's going to watch it. So, it's real short, but if you engage them in a story, I feel confident that they can hang in there for half an hour. I really do.
I think so too. You know, I've heard you tell stories and I've been enthralled. I've heard other great storytellers, and it's amazing to me. Suddenly you look down, 20 minutes, 45 minutes have passed and you have no idea. And I just think it's a gift, but you've worked at it over the years to try and really hone it. And one of the things I was going to ask is how can we bring emotion to the stories that we're telling? I really liked what you said earlier about GIT and getting to know the emotion of it and stories that have grabbed you. But how can we do that without melodrama or gimmicks? I know some people kind of get their shtick and they do their shtick and stuff, but how can we really impact people on an emotional level without resorting to that stuff?
Well, we can't resort to it, as you know, that's why you asked the question. We can't resort to it because then the story won't work. I've putting together my show, That Wonder Boy, which is very, very funny, but it has several really poignant moments. My director pointed out to me, she said, you know, do that section for me again. And I would do it over again. And she would say, you know, that language in there, it sounds way too literal, way too flowery. It doesn't sound like you. And I went back and I'm looking through the text and I'm going, well, you're absolutely right. You know, I wouldn't say it that way. I wrote it that way because as I'm writing, I got a little enamored by, wow, look what I'm doing with words here. Wow, this is really going to move people. And instead of going, no, just get right down to it and tell the story and keep it simple. Keep things real clear. What's happening here? And again, language is a part of that. And there are times, there's a time for everything in terms of how you're using language, what the words are that you're choosing. But sometimes we, in storytelling, for example, if if you bring in a piece of music, and I like to use music sometimes when I'm performing, especially if I'm working live with somebody that I really trust who can sweeten musically. And I'll say, when I get to this particular place, could you just sweeten in there a little bit? Oh, yeah, I can do that. And if the person is really skilled, it can be done so well. But if it's heavy-handed, right away people go, oh, here we go. Here comes the big turn. And, oh, I guess I'm supposed to feel emotional here. And so to answer your question, Stephen, I think it's a real fine line sometimes between what is too much and what is too little, whether it's the verbiage, whether it's the length, the words you're choosing, or whether it's music that you're bringing in. It's finding that the authentic place is a real challenge in all of art, but certainly in storytelling. Where is it authentic, right? And it's a very narrow place between now it's authentic and whoops, I put too much red paint in there, and now I've got to go back over because now it's too bright on that side, you know. So that is a challenge, and I'm not sure how to do it except to recognize that it's a fine line, and that might be helpful.
You know, one of the things over the years I've told people when I do seminars on storytelling is I'll say, write the story with your mouth. And they'll be like, what are you talking about, write with my mouth?
Yeah.
Like, you got to, if you're going to be presenting it out loud, write it out loud. Because just what you said, very often we'll have someone types up a story, then they try to learn or memorize, rehearse, or whatever they do, and they do it and it doesn't have that authentic feel. But if you practice it orally, just like, you know, it's pretty hard to do comedy without an audience, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you know, it's... And so practicing it in the medium that you're going to be presenting or performing it in, I think kind of is a shortcut toward that authenticity.
I think that's really good advice. And I actually write with my mouth and with my fingers at the same time, so that I'll be saying a phrase or finding the way that fits in my mouth, and I'll type it down. And then, okay, do I have it there? Let's turn this around there, because now the sentence is constructed better if I do it this way. Does it still work? Yeah, it still works. Then we'll type in this. Okay, now we'll try to say that. Now let's do the whole paragraph together. Well, I probably would not choose that word. Let's take another one. Let's make it simpler. And so it's back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. But I think that's good. That's good advice.
So as people want to check out some of your stuff, maybe online, maybe there's some videos, or you have a gig coming up or anything, what's the best place to look for your information? Website, Facebook, LinkedIn?
Yeah. I can be reached at boxstromberg.com, and there's a bunch of stuff there. I'm always putting things up on Facebook, and I'm always happy to have people come on there that would like to be friends on Facebook. And that's at, Pop Stromberg Facebook, I guess. And then on YouTube, there's just a bunch of stuff that people can watch on YouTube and or Vimeo. Just go in and type my name in there, and there's a whole page of stuff. So, and that's a fun way to see what I do if anyone's interested.
Well, Bob, it's been great talking with you, and it's also been just over the years, it's been neat to watch your career and watch all the different venues and the way that you tell stories through comedy, through on the stage, through one-person shows, and all that. And so I appreciate the time and also the friendship. And we
Right back at you. Thanks for your great work, too, Stephen. Appreciate it.
And do your best to keep my dad in line out there, all right? I know he needs some handling, so
your
keep
dad,
an eye out for me.
One of my favorite people, honestly. Just a wonderful guy.
And our thanks go out to everybody who's listening. For more info about our guests and to check out our other broadcasts, click to thestoryblender.com.
And, of course, like we always say, the art of the story, it's all in the blend.
Take care. We'll see you next time.